Now we're joined by Lance Daly, the writer-director of the Famine Time Revenge Western Black 47, and the inimitable Stephen Ray, who is one of the stars of the movie. You're both very welcome.
Thank you very much.
Thanks.
Lance, it's 5 years since your last film, I think, Life's a Breeze, is it?
Yes.
So why are you hesitating?
Why the... I'll try to only talk about the current film and not look back.
Well, no, actually, don't worry. We'll go straight ahead.
I understand. 5 years, yeah, because I was consciously just really thinking about the sort of films I was making and how I wanted to do it. And so it took a while to find something that fit a new model.
Well, that's what I was coming to.
Yeah.
Did it take a long time to raise the money? Did it... Were there other issues?
Yes. Yeah. No. It took time, but Muchtara Kelleher, the producer, was actually developing the film for a number of years before I came involved. So you know, and he'd had a few other versions of the film that were financed and didn't happen, and did happen, and you know, just or that were possible but weren't possible for whatever reason. So I sort of signed on quite late in the process.
Oh.
And then sort of we went about. Another different version again of what the film could be, because I think it was it was possible to do a film set during the famine that could be a lot of different things, you know. It sort of fit, but I'd spent a few years before that just trying to change gear, and then this was sort of a good fit for that, you know. So then we played through. Then it only took us a couple of years to get it done once we were all in.
And where did you come into it, Stephen?
Oh, just before we started shooting it, wasn't it? I was no more fundamental to the movie than that.
Well, I think you signed on a few months.
A few months, yeah. Okay. Yeah.
It's obviously a very, very strong ensemble movie. So did you get everybody that you wanted? Jim Broadbent, Stephen?
Yeah, it was
Paul Dumford,
Hugo.
Yeah, it was very. You know, finding James Freshfield to play Feeney, to play the Ranger, that was really the hard. That was really, really hard to find the right person for that role, and it's not the person you would expect who he ended up on. You know, so that was really the search. Everybody else, yeah, they were all first choices. We sort of said, who'd be perfect? Who'd be perfect for Sergeant Fitzgibbon? How about Mo Dumford? Who'd be perfect for, you know, and everybody was just really responsive, I think, to the script and to engaging with the story about the famine, which, you know, they were all interested in.
Yeah. I didn't know much about James Freckleville. He's believable, obviously, in the part. He's the kind of guy who could be beaten around the place and would endure.
Yeah. Yeah, he had an edge. I thought the first time I talked to him was by Skype. You know, he was in Los Angeles and he just had this sort of hard edge to him, which I don't find a lot of young actors have, you know. Mm. And he felt like he was from a different time. And also he was really, really, he really understood it, and he was really committed in a way that I knew somebody was going to have to be, because he had to learn Irish, he had to learn horsemanship,
yeah,
to grow a gigantic beard, which means not taking a part for 6 months before the movie, you know. Mm. And so it was just a level of commitment that he just seemed really, really strong on all those things. And he, honestly, like, we made some promises to each other in that first call. I said, look, if you don't do anything else, I'll fight for you. And it didn't seem like he was going to be the guy that everybody would agree to. He's not an obvious choice for that role or to, you know. Mm. And I said, look, I'll go all in on this, but you've got to go all in from today and start your training, your weapons and training and everything. And he did, you know. And so it was a big leap of faith. And there were many months went by where we didn't know whether we'd both made a terrible error and I'd have no movie and he'd have no movie, or whether, you know. But then when it came to it, I felt like he really delivered on his promise to me, you know, when we were there on the day, you know.
Wonderful actor. Yeah.
Yeah. Very cinematic. I mean, he's... Mm. This thing that keeps coming up about it being a Western, a famine time Western, would you go along with that?
Well, I would, to a point, in that it has the iconography of a Western, and it's set in... I think if you set any action movie in Connemara in 1847, it could look dangerously like a Western. Because you have horses, you have gunpowder, you have, you know, a few brimmed hats, and suddenly it's a group of men pursuing another man who's on a revenge spree, which is sort of a Western structure, you know. But I mean, I find the thing about the Western really interesting is just that the Western was about, you know, if it's set, first of all, Connemara is not a wilderness, and either was the West, and either was America. You know, America was populated by a native population, and the Western film, the Western genre kind of revised that into here's a frontier and people are going to go out and settle in this wonderful wilderness, but actually it's not a wilderness, it's somebody else's home. And actually it's the same in Ireland. As you know, Connemara, even now we think of it as, oh, it's quite a wilderness, but it was actually one of the most populated rural regions in Europe in that time. But that's all wiped out. That was all, that story in the landscape is all wiped out by the famine. And so it looks different now. But, you know, so as a Western, this is sort of a, this is like if you did a Western and it's the, what did you say, the Comanches or the Apaches or whoever. If you told a story from their point of view, you know, of which you know, has been touched on very little in American movies. So I like to call this a Western. It's like, you know, the Irish, I don't know.
Yeah.
And you didn't study up on the Western, did you? I remember interviewing you years ago. I think it was in the Shelburne, in which you were raved about Robert Mitchum.
Oh, yeah. I think he's one of the greatest actors of all time. Yeah.
Why? Why? What about him?
He does everything by thought. He just thinks. He doesn't. He doesn't emote. You know.
I asked you that years ago. I remember who's a good actor then.
And
in the middle
I say
of some
him?
Debate, you said Robert Mitchum, and I said why, and you said because he lets the audience come to him.
Yeah, and he just does it with thought. You can take the movie anywhere you want to go because he's thinking. He's just so intelligent. It's brilliant.
Yeah. Wonderful. I think he's incomparable, or was incomparable.
I think he is too. Yeah. And he just looks at a girl and it's sexy. You know, we don't have to have massive stripping or anything. You know, it's just, you know, I mean, there's too much ghastly emotion in acting these days, it seems to me.
Yeah. Presumably you're happy with the way the film turned out.
you look at me as if I'm mad.
No,
I think it's fantastic, the movie. I really do.
I really liked it better the second time for some reason. I can't understand why, but I did.
I'm glad you said that. That's my feeling about the film. Actually, the reason I am happy with it is I think it does stand up to repeated viewing.
Yeah.
In a way that I don't think anything else made as, like, there's something about it structurally, or I don't know, something about the essence of it that I found get more interesting. Even, I mean, I've seen it so many times, but I still, and a lot of people have said that to me on second and third viewings now, they're sort of revising it upwards. So I think that might be a good sign.
That's good. Yeah. What about CGI? Do you have to use much?
There's a lot of visual effects in the film. There's over 550 visual effects shots, but of those that you would look at and say that might be just making somebody a bit skinnier in the background, or it might be taking out a road, or it might be, you know, or it might be replacing the entire background, or take, you know, putting in a village that isn't there. So it's a big mix. But yeah, there is the landscape of Connemara in 1847 doesn't exist now. So, you know, it was totally wiped out, and it's either been developed or it's just, there's no trace of it. And also most people lived in cabins made of turf and bogwood. And so, you know, all of that is gone. And so to you know, it would cost, you know, 10 times what our movie cost to actually get into building those things, physically building those things, and taking over that much landscape and going into a village and shutting the roads down. So, yeah, I mean, computers are just increasingly, I mean, I wouldn't say CGI because that is like you're creating the whole thing in the computer, but what you're doing is blending different photographic elements. And so, yeah.
Stephen, could you talk a little bit about your relationship with Neil Jordan?
Oh, sure.
I mean, what is it, about 9 pictures now? Is it
11.
11?
Yeah.
From Angel to...
Right through to the recent one, Greta.
Yeah.
I was on 10 for quite a while, and I said, you know...
And what do you give to each other?
Oh, God. You'd have to ask him. I just always liked working with him, you know. I mean, look, he did his first movie, Angel, was my first movie. I never thought I'd be in a movie. I didn't know how you did it. Earlier we were talking about how younger actors today, they know they're going to be in movies. But when I started, I wasn't sure. And then Neil just said, I've got this film script, you want to do it? And he gave me a saxophone and a film script, and then we did Angel. And I've always liked him because he just he really knows nothing about acting. So he doesn't interfere with the process. Yeah, yeah. He just tells you the story a bit, you know. Says, "Well, don't forget that, blah blah." And you, I say, "Okay, yeah, okay." And no, I think he's, you know, I think he's an extraordinary filmmaker. And we were both agreeing that Butcher Boy is maybe the best Irish movie of recent times.
Yeah,
and yeah, he's great.
Yeah, you sometimes get the impression that the BBC sort of holds stuff for you. I mean, War and Peace with that what was he? Vasily, was that the character's name?
Yeah.
And
Prince Vasily, yeah.
And Dickensian.
Dickensian, and then...
These were great.
Yes, then there was the ones with Hugo Blick, which were great. Yeah. No, they're... Well, you reach a certain age where they actually think they don't try and limit your range so much. They just say, "Oh, you know, give him that." You know, I think War and Peace was really, really good.
Yeah, wonderful. Yeah,
yeah. To do it in 6 episodes, absolutely incredible.
Was it done sequentially?
No. We were all over the place. But, But you know, you got to go to St. Petersburg and all that, you know, it's really incredible.
I remember as well, and just jumping around the place, I remember as well, after Crying Game, there were stories about you possibly going to America. Did that ever,
I was in and out of America a lot, you know, but I didn't want to live there particularly. And then, for instance, one of the films they offered me immediately after with the Crying Game was a film about an IRA bomber, you know, and I said, you know, I don't want to be that character, you know. I think Tommy Lee Jones did it in the
Tommy end. Lee Jones did it. And every now and then you get people talking and writing about accents and what are the worst accents of all time. Tommy Lee Jones in Blown Away is incredible.
It's really bad, is it?
It's awful.
Well, Spacey was pretty bad in the one about Martin Cahill, Ornie Decent Criminal. Yeah,
but Cruise, as big a fan as I am of him, takes the trophy for Far and Away.
Far and Away.
Yeah, I think.
And Brad was pretty poor in
The one about Devil's Own. Harrison Ford.
You know, it's a hard accent to do, but...
Is it?
Oh, not for me.
Yeah.
But...
yeah.
But I think James Freshfield conquered the Irish accent.
No, he did. And actually, that idea to use Irish, was that yours idea?
Well, I mean, I think there was always Irish in the script even before I came to it. But it was, it's a natural consequence of making a film set in that place at that time.
Yeah, I don't think it was disruptive in any way. And I thought it lent credibility to the whole kind of enterprise, didn't it?
Yeah, I think it makes it, it just... And it was an old Connemara Irish that we used as well, I think, and in as much as we could, you know, as much as we were. Potter Cox was the translator, did a lovely job with it, but it just put it in another world for me, and I think it sort of activated something in an Irish audience as well that I don't think anybody expects to feel that way, as this sort of sense of ownership over it or something, you know. But James learned the Irish. He sings in Irish and his accent, you know, when we did the first test screening, it was in Dublin. And I said at the end, nobody knew James and they didn't recognize him from his previous movies because he had this big beard. Nobody knew who he was. And I said at the end, where do you think the actor who plays Feeney is from? And they got into a debate amongst themselves, about 50 people, about whether he was from Galway or from Mayo. So I thought that's okay. When I said he's from Australia, they didn't. They were like, "Nah, forget it." They didn't believe me at all. So he did. Yeah, he got it right. Yeah,
yeah. I always sort of go to the cinema a lot. I always sort of think about whether an actor can actually carry stuff like that, carry a beating, carry being thrown around the place. You see the likes of Mel Gibson or someone like that. You see whether I think he's about 5'6".
Yeah.
But you say to yourself, "How the name of God could he take this?"
Yeah,
James certainly does.
Yeah, no, James has a yeah. He's tough. You could break things over him, and he'd keep going. And he did. I mean, he didn't take any bad knocks making the film, but he certainly there was sort of a rumor going amongst the supporting cast as they'd come in, and after the first few, you know, actors were coming in to do a scene with him where they were going to be murdered by him, and they were getting really scared because he's pretty, you know, because he went for it. He didn't hurt anyone, but he was really like, he's really tough with people as well, you know. And it just, all that stuff just lends the, you know, just lends a texture and a life to it, which you can't buy.
And Stephen, your scenes with Jim Broadbent were very, very good, weren't they?
Yeah, well, I love Jim, you know, I've worked with him a few times, you know, and he's one of the great actors of our time, no question. And there's something funny about everything he does, isn't there? He's very amusing.
Yeah, I know, which is why he was interested in playing this part, because he was, you know, and I said to him, well, you know, he's a human being. Like, you know, I was sort of pitching it to everybody as well. This is a well-rounded character. He's got his good points, his bad points. And Jim was like, I want him to be completely irredeemable. And because he has. And actually, at one point in Berlin, he said to me, I said, people really buy it. Like, they really think you're really dastardly. And he says, well, you know, yes, but you still have to deal with the broad bent of it all. It's just a factor that follows him, that people think he's warm and cuddly. And he, you know, but he's got a real dark side as well, you know, which I think is what.
I've never met that in, well, in real life. No,
oh, no, but you can. Well, but he does it when he's on screen. You can see he goes. In a few other things, I'd seen it as well. There's just a dark heart there somewhere.
Yeah. Well, it's a great pleasure to talk to the two of you. Yeah. Thanks
very much.
Thank you.
Indeed. Thank you.
Thanks a million.